Good?
I appreciated your insights. So.
Yeah, I was just so disoriented yesterday. Okay. Okay, folks, quick reminder, if you needed one, that your third quiz is Monday, right? So if you're going to miss it, you need to let me know before 3:30 on Monday. I don't know why I have to keep repeating it, but for some reason, people still don't quite get that. So make sure you let me know before 3:30. Yep. I'll tell you, it's about slide one, the end of the capital structure section, 142, sometime about 50 minutes through today's session, 48 minutes maybe, 49. We'll hit the last slide. Yep. There is a review session, and it's going to be Friday. Okay? I think it's Friday 3 to 4, so I'll let you know, because I think that the 12 to 1 is a problem because of whatever. I'll keep you posted. I mean, it's going to be Friday. And it will be webcast with all the stuff that goes with it. Okay, so let's pick up where we left off on Monday. I do know that you're working on the project, so keep it moving. And the only suggestion I have is when you get stuck, just make an assumption and keep the process going. Okay? So on Monday, we were talking about matching up debt to your assets. Somebody remind me again what the advantage is. So if somebody says, you know, what's the big deal about matching up the debt to my assets? How do you explain to them, as a business, why matching up debt to your assets will help them? What's the benefit of matching up debt to your assets?
One example you gave was like floating debt.
Right.
So if you're a company that has pricing power, floating debt is better for you because when
And why is that good for me? So basically, with floating rate debt and I have pricing power and my income is higher, my interest expenses track my income. What's the benefit of having my interest expenses be high when I'm doing well and low when I'm doing badly?
Because when you're doing well, you can pay those interest expenses, but if you're doing poorly, they will adjust as well.
And it shows up in one or two places. I have a lesser chance of going bankrupt and I have a lower cost of debt and I can borrow more money, right? So keep it specific. It's not the abstract that's driving this. It's if you do this, you can borrow more money than you otherwise could have, and you can get a bigger tax benefit. Your value should get higher. So in the last session, I also said that one way to think about matching up debt is to think about your company, think about a typical project for your company, and then say, based on that intuitively, what kind of debt is right for my company. So Justin, who are you doing? What company? Verizon. What's a typical project for Verizon? Fascinating company at this point in time. What's a typical project for Verizon right now? What business are they in?
Telecom.
But basically, they're also, they used to be a phone company, right? They have that history, a legacy history, but they're not really investing much there because it's not like there's much money to be made. They're in so wireless is their big business. And to grow, what do they have to do? Build more towers, right? And or buy another company or buy. So if they're staying domestically, they've got to build more towers and get more people away from AT&T or T-Mobile. That investment, long term or short term? It's a long term investment, big infrastructure investment. So your debt has to be long term. Do they have pricing power? It's tough, right, in this business, because in a sense their pricing power comes from you using too much data, not from you charging you more for a plan, because it's a pretty competitive business. So I'd probably be a little reluctant to let them use floating rate debt. And the debt should be in what currency? Right now in dollars. So if they say we're going to go global, then the plans will change. Pick your company, think about intuitively what a typical project for your company is, work through the right kind of debt. Today I want to go a little further. I want to go beyond the intuition and talk about specific ways you can tailor the debt to your company. And I'm going to start off with a company that has just a few big projects. Remember I gave you the example of Boeing, only 8 projects in their lifetime? Let's say that kind of company. You're an infrastructure company that's building a toll road in Mumbai, big project, and you're saying, I want financing specifically for that project. There are relatively few companies which have few. So let's talk about how to match up financing or find the right financing for a specific project. You know whether you remember the Rio Disney theme park that we analyzed in capital budgeting. Right? Let's assume. And if you remember, the net present value for that theme park was about $3.3 billion. And we said Disney should take that theme park. Let's say that Disney decides to take the theme park. You've been hired to devise the perfect customized debt for the theme park. Here's one way to think about it. This is actually the cash flows and the net present value that I got. So you look at the first 4 columns. I just cut and pasted out our original capital budgeting analysis. Cash flows for the next 10 years. Terminal value discounted back at the cost of capital, the net present value was $3.3 billion. You're saying, why are we going back to capital budgeting? Notice I've added an extra column. In the last column, here's what I'm doing. I'm taking the present value of the cash flow in each year and multiplying it by whichever year I get the cash flow. So year 1, I multiply by 1. Year 2, I multiply by 2. I accumulate those numbers. That sum is $62.355 billion. You're saying, where is this going? If I divide the $62.355 billion, which is what I get by multiplying T by the present value, and divide by the present value, I get 18.9 years. This is called Macaulay duration. If you remember in fixed, did you do this in foundations? Did you talk about duration? You're saying, I don't remember. Okay. You did talk about duration. This is the simplest version of duration. If I ask you to compute the duration on a bond, this is how you compute the duration. You take the present value of each coupon, multiply by T, add them all up. You're saying, what does that even mean? Duration is like a weighted average number, right? So this project gets cash flows year 1, year 2, year 3, year 4, year 5, year forever. And I've got to come up with some weighted average number. That 18.9 years, roughly speaking, is the weighted average duration of this theme park. You're saying, why should I care? What are we trying to do? We're trying to match up debt to assets, right? So if you ask me what kind of debt should this theme park take, the debt should have a duration of roughly 18.9 years. Does that mean the debt has to have a maturity of 18.9 years? Generally speaking, when I look at the maturity of debt, will it be higher or lower than the duration number? 50-50 shot. Try higher. Higher, higher. That's exactly what you were saying. So basically, it should be higher, and here's why. If I have a 30-year coupon bond, the duration of that bond is going to be less than 30 years because I have cash flows coming in earlier. So a 19-year duration is like a 25 to 30-year bond. So if I were issuing a bond to fund this project, it'd be about a 25 to 30-year bond with a duration of about 18.9 years. And the rest of the debt is kind of self-explanatory, right? The cash flows are going to be in reais. So the debt has to be in reais. Should I make it floating rate debt? What's that going to depend on? Does Disney have pricing power? Does it have pricing power? Yeah, you can't exactly tell your kids, you know what, no, that Universal theme park is just as good, Harry Potter, Mickey Mouse, what's the difference? it's not going to fly. In fact, we know Disney has pricing power because all you need to do is look at the prices for Disney theme park tickets over the last 30 years. And they've been able to pass through every ounce of inflation and more to their customers. So if I were designing debt for this theme park, it would probably be debt with the duration of 19 years in reais and perhaps with a floating rate component. So if I had big projects, I could do this. I could do financing that's matched up to the projects. But imagine trying to do this for a Walmart. How many projects do you think Walmart takes in a year? What's a typical project for Walmart? Another store. I mean, in terms of products, Walmart actually has relatively few generic products they produce. They're a retailer, so a new store, right? So the question I'm asking, how many stores? They probably open hundreds of stores. If I take each store and try to get the perfect debt for the store, think of how much work I will have to do. And there's another problem. When you open 100 stores, you create a portfolio of stores, right? You're saying, so what? To the degree that cash flows move together, rather than funding each store with the perfect debt, I could fund the entire portfolio with the right kind of debt. So if you have a company which is not just a few projects, it's lots of different projects, it might be nice to know, well, given how this company looks, what's the right kind of debt for the entire company? So I'm going to take you through a process, and it's going to draw on your statistics a little bit. And I want you to hang in there, because part of you is going to say, this is too statistical, I'm going to let go. So I'm going to try to put it as intuitive a feel as I can to the statistical numbers, but I want you to think about what we're trying to do. So here's what I did for Disney. Disney, if you look at any typical year, has hundreds of projects. It's got movie projects, it's got broadcasting projects, it's got theme park investments. So if I tried to take each one of them separately, it'd be too much. So I took Disney as a company. I collected data on two variables. The operating income that Disney had every year for the last 30 years, and the enterprise value. Remember how we define enterprise value? It's value of equity plus debt minus cash. The enterprise value every year for the last 30 years. So here's what the numbers look like. From 1985 through 2013, that's 29 years of data, I have the operating income every year and I have the enterprise value every year. I also computed the percentage change in operating income and the percentage change in enterprise value. And if you look at those last two columns, during this period, Disney had some really good years and some really bad years. He's saying, what am I learning from this? What I'm trying to gauge is, under what conditions does Disney have a good year? What are the macroeconomic variables that are driving Disney's operating income on a year-to-year basis? So what I did was I visited the Federal Reserve website in St. Louis. It's called FRED. It's actually a great repository for all macroeconomic data, interest rates, inflation, exchange rates. If you've never visited it, try it out. It's the best database that I can think of. It's free. And it's incredibly user-friendly. And I collected four slices of data. So basically, for every year, from 85 through 2013, the first variable I collected was the change in T-bond rates on a year-to-year basis. So the way to read this is if you see a positive number, that's the year in which interest rates went up, T-bond rate went up. If you see a negative number, it's the year the T-bond rate went down. In the second column, I collected the percentage change in real gross domestic product. So this is a measure of how strong or weak is the economy. So when you see a positive number there, the economy went up. Negative number, the economy went down. In the third column, you see the percentage change in inflation. I'm trying to capture whether is this a year when inflation went up or inflation went down. And in the last column, I have the percentage change in the U.S. dollar. Against what? Against other currencies. And here there's a little bit of an issue, right? You're saying against which currency? Against the euro, the yen? Federal Reserve actually maintains a data set for what it calls the weighted dollar. Do you know what the weighted dollar is? It's basically they take the dollar euro, dollar yen, dollar peso, dollar real, and they take a trade-weighted average against all exchange rates. So when that number is a positive number in the last column, it's a year in which the dollar got stronger. If you see a negative number, it's a year in which the dollar got weaker. So I have four macro variables: interest rates, inflation, real GDP, and the weighted dollar. And what I want to see is how Disney is affected by changes in those macro variables. Because I think by finding that out, I'm going to be able to devise better debt for Disney. So let's start. The first variable I looked at was how Disney was affected by changes in interest rates. So when interest rates go up, Is Disney affected positively or negatively? And if so, by how much? So before I show you the numbers, when interest rates go up, do you think Disney is going to be affected positively or negatively? Well, we're not talking about inflation, we're talking about interest rates. Holding all its constant, when interest rates go up, is it good for companies or bad for companies? It's bad for companies. So when I run this relationship, first you should see a negative relationship. When interest rates go up, let's see if in fact that's true. I ran a regression of changes in Disney's enterprise value. Remember from 2 pages ago, again, changes in interest rates. And this is what I found. For every 1% increase in interest rates, Disney's firm value or enterprise value dropped by 2.33%. So you're right. Higher interest rates reduce the value. But I'm going to go further. Remember we talked about duration and I showed you how to compute the duration for a project? I'm going to argue that this regression actually is another way of estimating duration, and collectively this regression is telling me that the duration of Disney's assets is 2.33 years. It sounds mysterious. How the heck does a regression give you duration? Again, let me take you back to the foundations class. What is the duration of a bond measure? In addition to measuring when you get the cash flows, what's the other spin that you will hear on duration? What does it measure? How sensitive the bond price is to changes in interest rates, right? In fact, if you remember, there's a little calculus that starts off the duration measure, which says, for 1% change in interest rates, how much does the bond price change? So when I tell you the duration of a bond is 9 years, I'm actually also telling you that if interest rates go up 1%, the bond price will drop by 9%. Now do you see why the regression is another measure of duration? How did I read this regression? Every 1% increase in interest rates reduces my value of Disney by 2.32%. Therefore, roughly speaking, it is a measure of Disney's asset duration, the duration of its assets. You can't really, once you hit zero, you just have to ignore it. The coefficients you get, if this had been a positive coefficient, the best way to read it is that the duration for these assets is really small. There's another statistical problem with this regression. Does anybody notice what that problem is? What are those numbers in brackets below those coefficients? They could either be standard errors, which they're not, or t-statistics. You remember how to read t-statistics? Come on, second year business school. Actually, I shouldn't blame you. My daughter, who's a senior at William & Mary, who's graduating in a month, has a project to do. This morning she said, Dad, I've run these regressions in SPSS. I have no idea what they tell me. What is this T thing? Yeah? So it's, I guess you can get through almost a senior, almost graduating, and not know what the T thing is. First, you want that number to be a big number or a small number? Oh, come on. You want a big number. If it's a small number, there is no statistical relationship. In fact, the magic number usually for a t-statistic is about 2. Once you get above 2, you have statistical significance. If you have below 2, then it gets progressively lessened. If the number is close to 0, you basically have no real statistical. Now do you see the problem with this regression? What's a t-statistic I got for the change in interest rates? It's 0.39. So this is a very, very weak regression. We'll come back and talk about this because this is going to repeat itself on my other regressions. But to the degree that I trust this regression, which I don't very much, the duration of Disney's assets is about 2.32 years. So this is just a different way of estimating duration. And it looks at how the firm value changes as interest rates change. Justin, you had a question?
When you say firm value, you're talking about
enterprise value, basically. Well, I will talk about that because I'm also going to run that regression to see, because there are 2 questions I want to answer. How does your value change as interest rates change? And how does your earnings change as interest rates change? Because they give me different information about the same macro variables. Griffin?
Can you explain what the 790 was
on the previous slide? That's the intercept from the regression. So when you run a regression, you get output from the regression. So if you use Minitab, this will be the constant in the regression. So by itself, it just tells you the base from which you build off. It's actually the coefficient and the variable that you pay the most attention to. Yes? No. Operating income is a little tricky because it's like looking at the bond coupon changing as interest rates change. So this value is the measure of duration. Operating income is kind of an add-on that I'm going to do just to see how sensitive your earnings are to interest rates. So this is, and to show you how the two connect, when you think about the duration, you're thinking about how sensitive is the price of an asset to changes in interest rates. That's the most generic definition of duration. With a bond, I can do what I just did, which is to compute the present value, multiply by T, compute the duration for the bond, because I know what the cash flows in a bond are. I can't do that for a company, and that's why I have to run the regression, because I don't know what the future cash flows of Disney will be at different interest rates. So what I'm doing is I'm using Disney's historical data to get a sense of how sensitive is Disney as a company to changes in interest rates. So that coefficient, the B on the regression, becomes the duration of Disney's assets. So Disney's value drops about 2.3% for every 1% increase in interest rates. I reran the regression using operating income. And this was a question you asked, what does it tell me? Every 1% increase in interest rates, what happens to Disney's operating income? It drops by about 8%. Much more sensitive than my value is to changes in interest rates. What does it tell me? That if I'm Disney and I'm looking at future income, I've got to be very careful about interest rates going up. Because remember, we've been reading stories about how the Fed is going to move rates up. I don't know whether the Fed has that power, but if you believe that rates are going to climb from 1.8%, which is where they are now, to 4.5% in the next 2 years, that is bad news for Disney as a company, because it means their operating income is going to drop by 20, 21, 22% if history is any guide. Any questions? Yes, Justin. In fact, that's the issue. I'm using 30 years of data, right? 1985 through 2013. In 1985, Disney was a movie company that owned a couple of theme parks. In 2013, Disney's in movies, it's in broadcasting, it's in theme parks, it's global. And that's always the problem with historical data, is if the company is changing, this is, in fact, a problem we ran into with beta regressions, if you remember, right? This is in spades because I'm doing it over 30 years. I completely agree. And I'm going to give you a way out of that problem in a few minutes, because this is going to be an issue no matter which company you look at if it's been changing over time. But I have no choice. I need to go back in time to get enough data to run the regression. But that's putting me in the second danger zone. The company might have changed. Now, here's the second regression I'm going to run. I'm going to take changes in operating income and changes in firm value, and I'm going to run the regression against changes in real GDP. You're saying, what is that going to tell me? When we talk about companies being cyclical and non-cyclical, if you have a cyclical company, what are you telling me the company is doing? It's doing well when the economy is doing well and doing badly when the economy is doing badly, right? So when you run this regression, if you have a cyclical company, what should you expect the coefficient? So you're going to see a regression just like I did for interest rates. But if you have a cyclical company, what should the coefficient on real GDP look like? A big positive number or a big negative number? A big positive number. As GDP does well, my income should go up, my value should go up. If I have a counter-cyclical company, and sometimes you hear people talk about counter-cyclical companies, should have a big negative number, because then the economy is doing well, it's bad news for me. If I have a non-cyclical company, the coefficient should be close to zero. So what do you think Disney is? Cyclical, counter-cyclical, non-cyclical? I wager that we walked around, we could tell all kinds of stories, right? We could talk about how when times are bad, you're going to take your kids more to theme parks because everything else looks so awful. And that's part of the problem with storytelling, is we can go off in all these little alleys. But ultimately, here's the tiebreaker. The numbers don't lie. Or if they do, they lie in a very subtle way. So I ran the regression because I had no idea. Because I could tell good stories about cyclical, counter-cyclical, non-cyclical. And here's what the results look like. And you tell me, based on the results, whether Disney is a cyclical company or not. Every 1% increase in GDP growth translates into a 6.7% increase in value and a 6.46% increase in operating income. So I don't care what the stories are. The numbers seem to indicate that Disney is a cyclical company. And in this case, if you look at the T statistics, what did I say the magic dividing line was for T's? 2. So it's higher than 2. Statistically significant. This is a stronger relationship than the interest rate difference, but clearly if I believe this regression, and again you have all the caveats, and just net, it's a company's change over time, it looks like Disney is at least mildly a cyclical company. Now, I'll wager if I took Ford or GM and I run this regression, the coefficient is going to be much bigger than 2, much bigger than 6, because the more cyclical you get, the more you will be affected by changes in GDP. Question?
Wouldn't these regressions be more accurate if you did like multiple variables?
Okay, that's actually a very good question. I'm running these regressions as simple regressions, right? Each one variable. Sounds like a lot of work. Why don't we throw all 4 variables into that regression? Interest rates, GDP. Somebody tell me why I didn't do that? In fact, when you run multiple regressions, there's a very simple rule about independent variables. The independent variables are supposed to be uncorrelated with each other. Do you think there's any chance that GDP growth, interest rates, inflation, and they're all very highly correlated? And if you throw in 4 highly correlated variables into regression, you get what's called multicollinearity. And I remember hearing this in my statistics. I said, who the hell cares? I found out afterwards why I should have cared more in my statistics class. Because if you have multicollinearity, what happens? You confuse the computer to no end. It has no idea what each variable is standing for because they all start to swim together. So that's what stopped me from running a multiple regression, is a multiple regression will actually be less accurate because of the multicollinearity. It's better to have separate regressions against each variable to get a measure of how much that variable affects them. So that's why I ran simple regressions. Okay? So based on this regression, you have a cyclical company. Yes?
So if you have a younger company, but that also means that you have lesser data to actually have.
Yeah, if you have a company that's been around less than 5 or 6 years, don't even try this, right? Because you run a regression with 5 data points, it's just pure noise. Even with 30, think of how much noise I have in my regression. With 5, might as well not even try. You could try doing quarterly data. But it's really, really messy because then the relationship has to be really strong to show on a quarter-to-quarter basis. So here's my next regression. Yes, go ahead. Yep. Well, those are my T statistics. The A just means it's statistically significant at the 95% level. A B would be like, so just to remind myself that's significant. So basically, you know, in statistics, we usually add something to the T statistics. Say, hey, you should pay attention to this number. You could put stars if you prefer. Something to draw people's attention to. This is not just a random relationship. Here's my next regression. I took Disney's firm value and operating income and ran a regression against the weighted dollar. So again, help me out. If I find a big positive coefficient when I run this regression, what is it telling me about Disney? If the dollar is stronger, then it's helped by a stronger dollar, right? If I get a 0 coefficient, what is it telling me about Disney? That it's unaffected by the dollar. If I get a negative coefficient, that I'm hurt by a stronger dollar. Again, we can tell stories, right? A stronger dollar can hurt Disney at the theme parks. But as Disney increasingly becomes a global company, it's a much more difficult effect to work out. So again, I'm going to go to the numbers because I don't know where the storytelling is going to take me. So let me show you the numbers, and you tell me based on the numbers what you think Disney's relationship with the stronger dollar is. For every 1% increase in the dollar, my value decreases, but it's by a very small amount. So my value is not affected that much, but it is still affected negatively. But look at my operating income. For every 1% increase in the dollar, my operating income drops by about 1.68%. A stronger dollar hurts Disney as a company because for whatever reason, maybe fewer people come to the theme parks, that affects their revenues and their operating income. We don't know why, but it does seem to have a negative effect. So at this stage, well, here's what we have. Interest rates affect Disney negatively. The economy moving stronger helps Disney positively. The dollar getting stronger affects Disney negatively. We have one more regression to run. So here's the last one that I ran. I took Disney's operating income and firm value and ran a regression against inflation. Now let me get to Griffin's point about pricing power. If I have a lot of pricing power as a company, when I run this regression, what should I expect to see? When inflation gets higher, I should have higher operating income and higher value. When inflation gets lower, both should drop off. If I don't have pricing power, I should see a negative relationship. As inflation gets high, I'm going to get squeezed because I can't pass prices through, the inflation through to my customers, but I'm going to be squeezed on the cost side. You think, and we talked about this, we think Disney has pricing power because it seems to be able to push prices up. Let's see if the numbers bear it out. There you go. Every 1% increase in the inflation rate pushes up my value as a company by about 3%. Every 1% increase in the inflation rate pushes up my operating income as a company by about 8%. So to the degree that you trust this regression, it looks like the company has significant pricing power. Yes? Anytime, whether a stronger dollar hurts you or helps you, it means that you've got to get out of the domestic. If you're all dollar-based in your debt, and you find that a stronger dollar either helps you or hurts you, then something has to change about the way you fund this company. You have to bring in foreign currency debt. It's only if you get a zero relationship with the dollar that you can say, I don't care what currency my debt is in. Okay. Yes, Griffin?
But the firm value is not statistically significant.
Yeah, and you know why? Because even though you can push up income and you have inflation, when inflation goes up, you have higher earnings, right? You're saying that's good. When inflation goes up, what else changes? Cost of equity, cost of capital also go up. So what's happening here is you're able to pass the inflation through to your customers. You have higher earnings, but your discount rates also go up. So in a sense, you're not getting as much of an impact on your value as you did in the operating income. Yes? Oh, each of the numbers, the constant and the coefficient, have a t-statistic. So that's why you have two numbers in brackets. The first number goes with the constant. The second number goes with the t-statistic, okay? The coefficient. So basically, you can ignore that first t-statistic because you know, say, your constant is different from zero. It's not a big deal. It's a second t-statistic that matters. So remember again, I started off on this because I wanted to design Disney's debt, right? Let's bring this all together. So here's what I get. If I trust these regressions, and there's a big if here, here's what the regressions are telling me. Disney's assets have a duration of roughly 2.3 years. It is a mildly cyclical company. It has pricing power, and it's hurt by a stronger dollar. So if you can design debt to somehow at least partially alleviate these problems, I'll be better off. But here's where I'm going to pause. Each of these regressions was incredibly noisy and backward-looking. Does that sound familiar? Do you hear me use exactly those same words like 15 sessions ago? When I talked about beta regressions, didn't I say the same thing? And there, what was my solution to the problem? When I said regression betas are backward-looking and they're noisy, what did I jump to as my replacement? Bottom-up beta. And what's the advantage of bottom-up betas? I run a lot of these regressions. The average across a lot of companies will still be precise, even though each individual regression beta is screwed up. See where I'm going to go next? When I run these regressions against interest rates and inflation and GDP growth and exchange rates, each company, I'm going to get these really noisy numbers. But what if I could run this for 100 entertainment companies and then average them out? And I'm going to get a bonus. When I did bottom-up betas, remember the bonus I got? I broke Disney down into businesses and came up with a bottom-up beta by business. Hey, that's what I did. So in a sense, this part of the analysis is almost a replication of what I did with betas, but now I'm working with a different mission in mind. I want to design the right debt for Disney. So I broke Disney down into the five businesses, exactly the five businesses I broke it down for betas. In fact, in the last column, those weights are exactly the weights I used to get a bottom-up beta. But here, instead of averaging betas across the businesses, I'm averaging the coefficients I got against interest rates and GDP and exchange rates and the weighted dollar and coming up with a bottom-up estimate for Disney for each of these numbers. So remember that 2.3 that I got as my duration for Disney that was very noisy? I'm going to replace it with a 4.34. If you look at that first column, the regression against interest rates across Disney's business, that's 4.34. In fact, if you want me to design debt for Disney in each of its businesses, I can use these bottom-up estimates, say, your theme park business should have, you know. So for each one, I would basically design debt that reflects the duration of assets in that business. So these are the numbers I'm going to base my recommendation on. So here's what I see Disney as having, as what Disney should have as debt. It should have debt with a duration of roughly 4.3 years. Its debt, a significant portion, should be floating rate debt. Why? Because it does seem to have pricing power. And a significant portion of its debt should be foreign currency debt. Why? Because 18% of its revenues come from outside the U.S. So that's what I would expect to see when I look at Disney's balance sheet. I tried not to look at Disney's balance sheet until I finished doing this analysis, because I didn't want to prejudge what Disney did. I took a look at Disney's actual debt, and here's what I saw. Its actual debt has a weighted average duration of roughly 7.9 years. My duration note was 4.3, but remember, this is a maturity, so it's probably closer to 6 years duration of 5.5. I can let that go, because I know there's noise. So on that one, I'm okay. They're slightly more long-term debt than I would like them to have. But here are the two numbers that gave me a little pause. First, only 5.5% of their debt is foreign currency debt. And almost all of it is in Indian rupees and Hong Kong dollars. Strange, right? The Indian rupee debt they took on because they bought an Indian broadcasting company, and the Hong Kong dollars they took on when they built the Hong Kong theme park. 18% of their revenues come from outside the U.S. 11.5% come from Europe. I don't see any euro debt there. So it looks like they have far too little foreign currency debt. And only about 5.67% of their debt is floating rate debt. Again, given their pricing power, I'd expect to see 20, 25, 30%. So at this stage, here's what I would conclude. Disney's debt is far too long term, far too U.S. dollar, and far too fixed rate. Can I fix it? Let's suppose you wanted to fix this overnight. How would you do it? You want to take the debt, make it more short-term, more foreign currency, and more floating rate. I want to do it overnight. What can I do? You know what a swap is? Have you heard of swaps? Sounds fancy, but here's what a swap is. I give you $100 worth of something, and you give me something else worth exactly $100. And in the bond market, here's how swaps work. I have a fixed rate U.S. dollar debt. I swap it with you, and you give me a floating rate euro debt, as long as there's a fair market value. And there's a big market for swaps. So if I wanted to fix the debt overnight, it's relatively straightforward. I can go to the bond market and swap some of my long-term U.S. dollar fixed rate debt for shorter-term foreign currency floating rate debt overnight. I can fix my debt. I can also go to the derivatives market, options, futures, and try to fix my debt there. But there's another choice that I might consider making as Disney. Remember, 2013 was when they were starting to build the Shanghai theme park. Huge theme park. Probably by the time it's done, $10 billion will be invested in that theme park. And they get to decide how to fund that theme park. So in 2013, I'd come and ask you, let's suppose they decide to borrow the entire $10 billion to fund the theme park. So what kind of debt should I use? What do you think the answer is? Griffin? In other words, the first reaction you have is, we just talked about matching debt up. You should use Chinese renminbi, long-term fixed rate debt. But I'm going to say, no, that's if you want to match. But remember, as a company, you have too little euro debt, too little foreign currency debt. This is your chance to fix it, and too little floating rate debt. Why don't you issue $10 billion of floating rate euro bonds to fund the Chinese theme park? It's a complete mismatch on that theme park. But after you're done, if you look at what you have collectively as a company, you're going to be closer to where you'd like to be than you were before. You always have to step back from individual projects and think about the entire company and see if you can get back to sync. So when you think about adjusting debt, that's basically what you're doing. Is you're taking advantage of the options that are out there, swaps, options, futures, but you're also taking advantage of the fact that if you have new financing coming up, that gives you a chance to fix something that you would like to get fixed. So very quickly, I'm going to take the other companies in my sample and work them through and make sure that their debt is right. So if I look at Bookscape and ask you what kind of debt would you expect them to have, they're a bookstore in New York City, right? I would expect them to have debt that matches up to the assets. So my recommendation for them, because they're a New York-based retailer, is to have dollar debt, long-term debt, because a bookstore has a long life, and probably fixed rate debt. What pricing power does a bookstore have? What they actually had were leases. And you know what? That actually makes sense. Leases are long-term. They're dollar-denominated. They're actually connected directly to the store. There's a reason why retailers use leases, and you can see what. So Bookscape, I'm okay with. Let's take Vale. Typical investment for Vale is an iron ore mine somewhere, Canada, Brazil. Iron ore is sold into a global market that's dollar-denominated. This is true for almost all commodities. So their typical project is long-term. It's U.S. dollar-based because that's what they sell into. And if I could, I'd love to tie the coupon to commodity prices. You see why? Remember 3 years ago when they went and borrowed, iron ore prices were 90 and they thought they could pay the debt. Now it's down to 45 or 40 or 35. So if I could, my perfect debt would be long-term dollar-denominated debt with a coupon tied to commodity prices. Then I looked at what they actually had. They had about 66% dollar debt, so at least they're most of the way there. Pretty long term, 14.7-year maturity for the debt. They're the company that had the longest maturity debt. But almost none of their debt was tied to iron ore prices. Maybe they have good reasons for not doing it. But if I could fix it, that's one place I would fix it, is why don't you try to fix your coupon based on what commodity prices do? So that's my gap with Vale. With Tata Motors, a typical project is opening another assembly plant to make cars. So if I were designing debt from scratch, it would probably be medium to long term because that's a pretty long term investment. Probably fixed rate debt because at least in India, Tata Motors has very little pricing power. It's a very competitive auto landscape. And to the extent that they're increasingly looking at growing through Jaguar Land Rover, and remember what Jaguar Land Rover's biggest market was. Come on, this is the answer to every question you get stuck on. Come on, give me the answer. China. Hey. In fact, try this out. Almost any question I ask you, if you're confused about what to say next, just throw in China. So what does duration mean? China. It kind of works. I'll have to work it through in my head. So that's pretty good. China worked for me. You know? So as they go increasingly into Jaguar Land Rover, they have to start thinking about foreign currencies. Their existing debt is a mix of Indian rupee debt and euro debt. The euro debt came from Jaguar Land Rover. The Indian debt came from their Indian operations. Average maturity about 5 years. Almost entirely fixed rate debt for the moment. Nothing seriously off, but as they grow globally, I would expect to see the proportion of their debt, which is non-rupee debt, become higher. Then I took a look at Baidu. Technology company, fast-growing company, risky business, right? I would expect their debt to be convertible debt, not because they're a growth company. I would expect the debt to be in Chinese. Remember, I've never talked to anybody outside China who's ever used Baidu. Maybe you use it every evening when you get home. Tell me if you do. You know? I would expect its debt to be almost all Chinese, remember, debt. What I saw instead was 82% of Baidu's debt is in U.S. dollars or euros, and none of it is convertible debt. Clearly, the debt is mismatched. But I'll give them an excuse. In many countries, when you go to borrow money, if the only place you go to borrow money is a bank, it doesn't matter what you think the right kind of debt for you is. The right kind of debt for you is whatever the bank is. So for a long time in emerging markets, if you looked at almost every company in the market, they all had three-year fixed rate loans. Why? Because that's the only thing. It's like buying a Model T, right? You go in Ford in 1926, they're like a car. It's black and it's a Model T. Can I get in blue and no Model K? No, black Model T. That's basically how banks behave. You come in and it doesn't matter who you are, three-year fixed rate loan for you. It's like one of those Saturday Night Live commercials. You know, have you ever seen this? No, forget about it. You've not seen it. It's really old. Everybody who comes in is a no Coke, only Pepsi kind of thing. You have no idea what I'm talking about. Just let it go. Okay? So that's a mismatch. But you see what I'm doing with every one of my companies. I look at what I'd expect to see as debt, look at what you actually have, and if there's a gap, I try to say, can I bridge this gap? So that's what I want you to do with your company. Even if you don't run the regressions, and you don't have to, I want you to think about what the right kind of debt you'd expect to see in your company is, what it actually has, and if there's a gap, tell me what you would try to do to bridge the gap. Exactly. And that's why I said that approach works only if you have, if you're a company with 7 or 8 projects, which means in any given year, you're probably looking at this is your project for the next 7 or 8 years. So when Boeing takes a project, it becomes the company for the next 8 years or the next 10 or the next 15. Or if you're a toll road company, that becomes the project. So most companies, project-specific financing can be a very dangerous way to fund a company because it's really a collection of projects or a portfolio of projects. Yes. That's actually an excellent question. Did everybody get the question? Let's say you're a Saudi company. And all your cash flows are in Saudi riyals. And you borrow in US dollars. That sounds like a mismatch, right? But you know what the Saudi company's defense will be? The dollar is pegged to the riyal, so basically there's no difference. I can borrow. And in fact, Saudi companies do this all the time. In many pegged currencies, you see this issue of companies borrowing in a foreign currency and funding domestic projects with the protection of we're pegged, what can happen to us. 1998, you know the Argentine peso was pegged to the US dollar? You went to Buenos Aires, you could pay in dollars, get repaid in pesos. So basically it was a peg. And Argentine companies did exactly this. They went and borrowed money in US dollars and took projects in Argentina. Everything's great, right? And in 2001, the Argentine government had to unpeg the currency. Why did they have to unpeg the currency? For currencies to be pegged, you know what has to be true? The inflation rate in the two currencies has to be roughly the same. Because if it's not, it's like putting a lid on a pot of hot water, turning the heat on full blast, and expecting the lid not to blow. The inflation in Argentina was 8%. The inflation in the U.S. was 1%. They kept the currency pegged, but at some point in time, they couldn't keep it pegged anymore. So they'd unpeg it. Saying, what's the big deal? The day after they unpegged it, 40% of Argentine companies went bankrupt. You can see why, right? All your debt is in dollars. Until yesterday, you didn't have a problem, but today you have a problem. So if you peg... if you use pegging as your reason for mismatching, be very careful. In fact, in the last 3 months, I've got more emails from Saudi analysts than I have in the rest of my life. And it's all around this issue. Because until about 3 months ago, people assumed Saudi riyal, US dollar, pegging, what's the big deal? You know what the big deal has become? As oil prices have dropped, the Saudi government is facing a budget problem. And one way to solve the budget problem is to cut costs. They cut subsidies. They cut. The other is to unpeg your currency. So there's at least the chance now it could get unpegged. And all these Saudi analysts have spent 2 decades assuming you can use dollar rates when you value Saudi companies. And all of that could get blown out of the water if this changes. So be careful about pegging. You know, for the moment, it looks okay. But it can work only in currencies where inflation rates are similar. If the inflation rates start to vary, I would very quickly ask you to get out of that mismatch before the market adjusts, before the unpegging happens, because once it happens, it's too late. Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Roy. No, dollars have nothing to do with it. Because you borrowed in dollars, you're paying in dollars. Dollar being weaker doesn't help you. I'll tell you what will make it easier for you to pay your contractual obligations. Is if you borrow money when inflation is low, and inflation goes up, it makes it easier for you to pay off your debt. Why? Because you're paying it. So inflation can make debt easier, but not the dollar. Right? You know what the dollar weaker helps you on, right? If you're an export-oriented company, it makes your products more competitive. So that's the place. So some companies can be helped by a weaker dollar, right? And that's coming from the fact that they're selling overseas and they essentially are getting are offering a price cut to their customers. Question?
Yeah. How do you find the right rate of countries where the government controls the currency and it's not?
How do you find a list of countries where the exchange rate is fixed?
No. How do you
It controls it until it cannot control it anymore. That's why I'm saying, look at fundamentals. What's pegging? Pegging is controlling, right? Yeah. Pegging is the ultimate control. But it works only on if the fundamentals support that. So a government can try to control exchange rates, but if inflation is working against them, the controls can't last very long. It's going to blow. And it's your job as a business not to look at what's controlled right now, but what's coming down the pipe. So I'm saying that's my response to the pegging as well, is look under the numbers to see how much control the government actually has over exchange rates, because nobody really controls exchange rates forever. So now let's move to the third and final aspect of corporate finance, which is dividend policy. Somebody asked me about, so the slide before this was the last slide for the quiz. Okay? So now you can relax because this is not in the quiz. You can go to sleep. You can do whatever you want. But this is actually the fun part of the session. So we're going to talk about dividends. And remember what dividends are. If you cannot find investments that make your hurdle rate, return the cash to the investors, right? So there are two questions I want to look at. One is, when I look at a company, I want to address the question, how much cash can this company return if it decides to return cash to its investors? How much can it return? And I'm going to compare it to what it actually does. And then once you decide to return cash, I'm going to ask a second question. Should you return it as dividends or should you buy back stock? Now, in doing all of this, there's a central point I'm going to come back to. When I ask you how much cash does Apple have, you're going to say lots of cash, $200 billion. But I'm going to argue that that's not true. Apple doesn't have any cash. They hold their stockholders' cash for them. We think of cash as belonging to companies. It doesn't. Cash belongs to stockholders. They've allowed the company to hold on to the cash. So let's look at how to answer those two questions. Now, if you run your company logically, here's how the process should work. You should start off by running the business, your factories, your production. You get cash flows from your business, right? Once you get the cash flows from the business, you're going to pay off debt, interest payments, principal payments, whatever's left over. It's cash available to go on to equity. But you're not going to pay that all out because you'll then have to look at what kind of investments can I take. If you have good investments, you're going to take those investments. And whatever's left over after taking those investments is the cash available to be paid out to stockholders. I'm actually going to give you a very simple way to measure that cash. It's called free cash at equity. We'll come back to that in a couple of sessions. But this is the cash available. But you're a public company. You can choose to return that cash or you can hold on to the cash. If you hold on to the cash, it builds up as a cash balance. That's how Apple and Google end up with big cash balances. If you choose to return it, you can return it either in the form of dividends or buybacks. So in a well-run business, investment policy comes first, financing policy comes next, and whatever's left over is what you pay out as dividends or buybacks. Do you think that's the way the real world works? In most companies, here's the problem. Companies decide what to pay in dividends first, and then they work backwards through this graph. Last week, I was in Houston talking to the finance team at Royal Dutch Shell, big oil company. You know how much dividends Royal Dutch paid last year? $9.3 billion. You know how much dividends Royal Dutch paid the year before? $9.3 billion. You know how much dividends Royal Dutch paid the year before that? $9.3 billion. You're saying, so what? 3 years ago, the oil price was $80 a barrel. Last year, it was 60. Or 2 years ago, it was 60. Last year was $40. Royal Dutch lost money last year. And they're still paying out $9.3 billion. Why? They're afraid to cut dividends. But here's what's happening in the company. They have to pay out $9.3 billion, and then they say, what do we do now? We're $9.3 billion in the hole. We have to go borrow money. Oh, that's not enough. We have to cut back on projects. It's almost like they've reversed the sequence where dividends are driving financing and financing is driving investing. It's not the way it's supposed to be. But that's why I describe dividend policy as the most dysfunctional aspect of corporate finance, because it reverses everything on its head. In fact, there are two words that come to mind whenever I look at dividend policy. The first is inertia. What does that mean? Most years, as I said, most companies pay out what they did the previous year. Inertia means you don't want to change. The other is me-tooism. So ask Royal Dutch, the finance team, why do you guys keep paying these big dividends? You know what their answer was? Because these nine other big oil companies all pay big dividends. We have to pay big dividends because they're paying big dividends. But they're not losing money. ExxonMobil can pay dividends. They said, it doesn't matter. We have to look like them. Inertia and me-tooism. And that, I think, is at the heart of why companies get into trouble with dividends. So I'm going to take you through a series of descriptive graphs of dividend policy. Okay? You had a question?
Yeah. Isn't there a reason if it's a company that's starting to pay dividends, for example, Exxon, and all of a sudden they cut their dividends, investors are going to leave and their share price is going to collapse?
Now back up. Give me that last part. What do you base the conclusion that if I don't pay dividends, why would you leave? And are there other people who will buy stocks that don't pay dividends?
They'd rather buy. Why would they come to this stock?
Why not?
Because it's a show of instability.
Is it wrong to signal the truth? I mean, basically you're saying if I cut dividends, people will think it's bad news. Hey, but look, they open the paper, they see the bad news, right? Oil prices are down, half of oil companies are in trouble, their rating is dropping. So you're surrounded by bad news when you don't cut dividends in the face of bad news. You know what you're signaling to me? That you're in denial. And that scares me a lot more than you cutting dividends. So right now in the commodity space, the companies that are in the most trouble are companies that are paying big dividends and have borrowed a lot of money. You can see themselves digging deeper and deeper into the hole and you're saying, please stop. But they can't seem to stop because they're so afraid that if they cut dividends, people will leave. And my reaction is, hey, if you can't afford to pay the dividends, it's better to cut dividends and have them leave today. Because eventually, guess what? You're going to have to cut dividends. It's a question of whether you're going to do it today or whether you're going to wait a week and do it or wait 2 years. So if it's a temporary problem, it's a one-year drop in oil prices, you can say, oh, I can get away with it. But this has been 3 years, and you've got to stop and ask, maybe this is not going to bounce back to $80 a barrel. And that's, I think, what oil companies have to factor in. And at the end of this process, I'll give you a suggestion on how I think oil companies should set dividends, which actually will allow them to pay big dividends in good times and smaller dividends in bad times and not worry about the signaling that gets kicked in. Yes, Roy? Oh, yeah. It's not like oil companies have seen stock prices go up in all of this. So investors clearly are factoring into the price that you're in bad times. The only person who seems to think that the market is going to be surprised by a dividend cut is sitting in the CFO's office of each of these companies. They seem to think that somehow doing this will send that signal that they're in trouble. But I think everybody knows that you cannot sustain these dividends. Might as well face up to the facts. So I'm going to give you a few descriptive statistics or a few descriptive words about dividends and use a graph to back it up. My first graph is a blank graph. Actually, it should be I don't know what happened here. I lost this slide this morning. If you ask me to describe dividend policy at most companies, the word I would use is sticky. You know what I mean by sticky? Take a look at your lecture notes, because obviously you take a look at this, there's nothing there. What this graph shows is the percent of companies in the U.S. each year that increase dividends, decrease dividends, and do nothing to dividends. So three columns, increase, decrease, do nothing every year. Take a look across the graph. Which of those three groups is the dominant group every single year? Every single year, the percent of companies that do nothing to dividends exceeds the number of companies that either increase or decrease dividends. Most of the time, companies pay what they did last year. Among the companies that change dividends, which is more common, increases or decreases? Increases outnumber decreases 5-1. Companies are reluctant to change dividends, and when they do, they're far more likely to increase dividends than decrease dividends. File that away, we'll come back and talk about it. Second, and one way to think about this stickiness is I took the worst quarter in the last 50 years in U.S. market history, the last quarter of 2008. If there was a quarter where companies should be cutting dividends, this should be it, right? The market's melting down. The whole world is changing. In that quarter, the fourth quarter of 2008, more companies than ever cut dividends, 17. But even in that quarter, look how many companies increased dividends. 32 companies in the worst quarter in the last 50 years increase dividends. That shows you how sticky dividends are. That in the midst of the worst crisis, there are still companies that are increasing dividends. Yes. Not in the S&P 500. Right? These are the S&P 500 companies. You know, so when you look across all companies, it's true they don't pay dividends. But among the companies that pay dividends, so this is among the companies that pay dividends. I'm not counting zero to zero as no change. Okay? I'm actually counting only companies which pay dividends. Okay? Here's a second word I would use to describe dividends, follow. Dividends tend to follow earnings. They don't lead earnings. They're not contemporaneous with earnings. You're saying, what the hell are you talking about? Let's say you own stock in a company. And you have a really good earnings year. Your earnings are up 30%. Don't expect your dividends to go up this year. Let's say you have two good years in a row. Earnings are up 30% this year. They're up 30% next year. Maybe your dividends will increase next year. If you have three good years in a row, by the third year, maybe the company will get around to changing dividends. It takes a while between earnings changing and dividends changing. Did you read the Goldman Sachs earnings report yesterday? Would look at it. If any of your job offers from Goldman, I'd look at the fine print because it might not be there by the time you get out. No. Really bad quarter. In fact, they've had every aspect of the business is melting down. But guess what? I wouldn't expect dividends this quarter at Goldman to be changed because of that. But if there are four bad quarters like this, two bad years like this, then maybe you're going to see a dividend effect. It takes a while. Dividends follow earnings. The third aspect of dividends is who gets these dividends? When companies pay the dividends, who gets them? You and I as stockholders, right? Up till now, whenever I've talked about taxes, I've talked about corporate taxes. That when they borrow money, they get a tax benefit. Now I want to talk about you. You're an investor. You get a dividend. You have to pay taxes on the dividend. If you've not been paying taxes on your dividends, I'd be very careful. Go back and look at all your... So if you get dividends, you get tax. But what's the other way you make money on stocks? The stock price, if you buy the right stocks, of course. Your price goes up, you get price appreciation, capital gains. So you get dividends and capital gains. And historically in the U.S., the two have been taxed differently. From 1913 through 2003, that's 90 years of U.S. tax history, you know which got taxed higher? Dividends were taxed at a much higher rate than capital gains. Dividends were treated as ordinary income. Capital gains were taxed at a capital gains tax rate. It's a big deal. In 1980, the first year I filed taxes, I paid 60% of my dividends as taxes. And I paid a capital gains tax rate of 24%. That was actually set for about 30 years in U.S. tax history. Dividends were taxed at the ordinary tax rate, which of course got up as high as 70, 80, 90%. The capital gains tax rate was set at 40% of the ordinary tax rate. So you were taxed at a much higher rate on dividends than on capital gains. That was embedded in the way corporations behaved for 90 years. In 2003, for the first time in U.S. corporate history, the first Bush tax laws were passed, the Tax Reform Act, the tax rate on dividends and the tax rate on capital gains were both brought to 15% and matched up. So after 90 years, dividends and capital gains are being taxed at the same rate. It happened in the last quarter of 2003. You think this is going to change the way companies pay dividends? Now that I brought down the taxes you pay on dividends, as a company now when I pay dividends, you're going to be happier to get those dividends. That quarter, Microsoft paid a $33 billion special dividend. They would never have done this before the tax law changed, but they did it because they said, hey, the tax law has changed, we'll pay more in dividends. In fact, there was a tick up in dividend paying, both by the S&P 500 collectively and in individual companies paying dividends because of that tax law. That tax law, though, was one of the worst constructed laws in history because since they didn't have enough votes in the Senate to make it permanent, it had a 10-year life. And at the end of 10 years, the entire law disappeared. It's the strangest tax law ever. And the rationale was, you have 10 years, you'll fix the problem, right? But we're talking about the U.S. Congress. So you get to the last quarter of 2012, and you have 3 months left on the law. December 31st of 2012, if they hadn't acted, the entire law disappears and the law goes back to what it was in 2002 when dividends were taxed at 40% and capital gains were taxed at not 15%. Nobody was quite sure. This was called the fiscal cliff. It was, in fact, a big issue with markets. The fiscal cliff was coming. And nobody was sure whether Congress would act in that last quarter. So guess what companies started doing in that last quarter? They started paying out dividends like they were going out of style. In fact, 233 companies paid out $31 billion in dividends just in that quarter because they were worried tax laws would change. Yeah. Well, because you're not, maybe the way to think about it is before the tax law changed, maybe they wouldn't pay dividends at all. So if you're a tech company like Microsoft, you said, I'm not paying dividends because my stockholders are going to get punished when they get dividends. And after all, who's the largest stockholder in Microsoft in 2003? Bill Gates. When you pay a big dividend, guess where those dividends go? They go into your pocket. And once they go into your pocket, guess what? You're paying out 40%. So this is personal. It's not about even you or I. So the way to think about it is before the tax law changed, maybe there were lots of companies holding back on dividends saying, we don't want to create that tax penalty. And now the tax law has changed, they're paying out more saying, hey, it's okay now. You know when Congress finally fixed the tax law? December 28th of 2012. And now dividends and capital gains are still taxed at the same rate. It's now 24% instead of 15%. But at least the tax rates are still the same. So tax rates or taxes do affect dividends. A little bit about the rest of the world. This dividend tax advantage is not universal. In the UK and Australia, if you're an investor who receives dividends, when you calculate taxes you'd have to pay, you're allowed to offset the taxes the company has already paid before they paid out the dividends. So I'll give you an example. You receive $100 in dividends. Your tax rate is 35%. And normally you'd pay $35 in taxes, right? But if you're in UK or Australia, you calculate the $35, and if the company has already paid a 30% tax rate, you take 30% of 100 million, you take 30 million, you subtract from the 35, you have to pay only 5 million in taxes. Which means in the UK and Australia, dividends are actually taxed at a lower rate than capital gains. So guess what? Guess who the biggest dividend payers in the world are? They happen to be British companies and Australian companies because of the way dividends are constructed. In India, capital gains are not taxed. Dividends are. Again, tax law will affect dividend policy. So when you look at a country, try to look at the investor level taxes on dividends and capital gains because it is going to drive dividend policy. Here's the fourth feature of dividends that I think is the biggest shift in the way to think about dividends. When I would start dividend policy, and this was more than three decades ago, dividends were paid out, cash was returned only one form, dividends. Companies hardly ever bought back shares. 81, 82, stock buybacks were unheard of. In the mid-80s, you started to see companies start to buy back more and more stock, and that trend kind of kicked into high gear in the 1990s. In this graph, it's very tough to read, the first bar is stock buybacks. So you take 1988, there were about $60 billion in stock buybacks, $100 billion in dividends, and I've graphed the two numbers out over time. And I've also graphed out the percentage of cash flows every year that U.S. companies have been returning in the form of buybacks. So you go to the early 90s, they used to return about 25 to 30% in buybacks. By the time you get to the second half of the graph, companies are now returning more than 60% of their cash flows in the form of stock buybacks. This is by far the biggest shift in dividend policy. So why do you think, and this is, the facts are clearly on the ground, you can't contest them anymore. Clearly U.S. companies are increasingly shifting to stock buybacks, return cash. So my question is a very simple one. Why the shift to stock buybacks at U.S. companies? Why have companies shifted away from dividends into buybacks, you think? Yes, Abby. That's absolutely true, but hasn't that always been true? So why is it that pre-85 that same argument wasn't used to buy back stock? Dividends have always been sticky for 100 years. So I agree with you. Stock buybacks are more flexible. So what do you think changed in the underlying economy that's made that argument stronger now? When you increase dividends, it's sticky, right? And you're going to be okay about paying sticky dividends if you feel secure about your earnings in the future. Everybody agree? 30 years ago, if you asked me to list out 200 companies with nice, stable earnings, I'd have had no trouble. I'd have started with the utilities because they had monopolies. But I'd also take consumer product companies, companies in local markets, and these companies, you can feel pretty sure about the earnings. There are nice markets, they control these markets, everything's okay, they can pay dividends. Today, I'd have a tough time coming up with a list of 20 companies with secure earnings. The utilities are now all gone, right? Technology is taking care of it. Even companies like McDonald's, which we thought would last forever, Coca-Cola, are finding that their business models are coming under assault. Everybody is feeling less secure about the future, including all you guys. And guess what? As we all feel less secure, we're going to be less likely then to increase dividends now because we're worried about whether we can sustain them. In fact, I'll give you the analogy that probably best explains the shift from dividends to stock buybacks. You guys are a little young for this, so I hope you get, you know, don't get too shocked. I told you about my daughter, 20 years old. She's going to graduate next month from William & Mary. But when she was 8, I was given the task of ferrying her to a birthday party. She was a tiny little creature, so even at 8, she had to get into a car seat. She gets strapped in, back seat. She demands that I turn the radio to Z100, a station I absolutely detest. I think it plays the same song over and over again all day long. I said, you know, I tried to negotiate with my daughter saying, could we listen to some jazz instead? She said, I don't want to listen to that mourning and whining. I want Z100. Very persistent creature, tiny but persistent. So finally I had to give in. I turned it to Z100. And I'm listening to songs and I kind of said, this is giving me a headache, but no, what can I? No, and I'm driving to it. And then the song stops and the DJs start to talk to each other and talking about people I've never heard of, songs I don't even think exist. And then they start talking about hooking up. And part of me, I mean, I to show you how disconnected you get after about 22 years of marriage, I had no idea what they were talking about. And then my daughter pipes in from the back seat trying to explain to me what hooking up is. Now, part of me is in shock that my 8-year-old is explaining what hooking up is. She didn't quite get it, but I kind of got what she was trying to say. But the other part of me was saying, this is a great way to explain the difference between dividends and stock buybacks. Dividends are like getting married. Right? You get married in sickness and in health, in good times and in bad times. You have to keep paying them year after year after year after year after year after year, forever. Stock buybacks are like hooking up. Here's $5 billion. Don't know your name, but it doesn't matter, right? So in a sense, whenever you think dividends, buybacks, that's a way to think about it. Dividends are like Match.com. Stock buybacks are like Tinder. That's pretty much it, right? So that's markets are shifting, and they're shifting not just in the U.S. In fact, let me show you a statistic to show you that this is not just U.S.-centric. This actually shows you the percentage of cash return in buybacks around the world. So you think this is just a U.S. phenomenon? Let it go, because increasingly around the world, you're starting to see companies shift into buybacks. And in the markets where you don't see buybacks, it's because there are restrictions on buybacks. India, for instance, 0.14% of the cash was returned in the form of buybacks. But that could very quickly change if the rules in the Indian market are changed. So this trend towards buybacks, to me, makes complete sense. Dividends have never made sense to me, to be quite honest. Because what did I define equity as? As a residual claim, right? You did whatever's left over. How can you tell me whatever's left over is a fixed number every year, $9 billion every year? That doesn't make sense. So dividends have never made sense. Buybacks actually make a lot more sense. So I think increasingly you're going to start to see that happen. It's just flexible dividend policy. So I'm going to leave you with a final picture. Kind of capture how different dividend policy is across countries. So this is the G7. I don't know who decided to add Russia to this mix. It never has belonged. It's G7 plus Russia. I never call it G8. It's G7 plus Russia. You look at G7, and then you see Russia. Does Russia look different? It looks like they pay no dividends. This is terrible, right? You say, maybe Russian companies can't afford to pay dividends. I looked at the cash flows. Russian companies can afford to pay dividends. They just choose not to. So here's my suggestion. Buy shares in a Russian company and try to put pressure on the Russian managers to pay dividends. My suggestion is, though, while you're doing this, don't fly to Moscow. You might end up in jail somewhere. What I'm trying to say is corporate governance in Russia is non-existent. And if corporate governance is non-existent, if you and I as stockholders have no power to push for cash to be returned, guess what managers are going to do with the cash? They're just going to hold on to the cash. Russian companies are cesspools into which cash disappears and doesn't come out, and there's not a thing that you and I can do about it. So when you look at big differences in dividend payouts across countries, the other thing to factor in is differences in corporate governance. The stronger governance gets, the more cash will get returned to stockholders. The weaker it gets, the more cash will get accumulated in companies. So I will see you on Monday for the third quiz. Look at the sectors they're in and look at the sector numbers over time. So if you're a technology company, you can look at the collective revenues of technology companies. Yeah, come up with me. Yes.
I have two questions. Yeah. One quick quiz and one quick question. I'm just wondering, like, how you just come up with one of the levered datas for question one? That's from the answer team. I wasn't sure how to all of
that. Well, remember the beta is what you use to get from your street rate for cost of equity, right? So if you work out the equation, it's your street rate plus beta times equity risk rate. The problem gives you the cost of equity, it gives you the risk rate, so it's your speed, you decide. So all I'm doing is working backwards.
Okay. And then for the project, my company, my portfolio, they have no debt.
Do they have leases?
Yeah,
you still have to look at debt policy, because you have to ask, can they afford to have more debt? So you can still do the other. Yeah. So that's fine. Okay. Hi.
I was looking at this spreadsheet on the valuation of GoPro, and in the cost of capital operations, you had a rating, the credit rating for GoPro, right?
Synthetic rating. Is there an actual rating?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe there is.
I googled it, but there wasn't actually an actual rating for it. So I was wondering if I was going about it wrong or...
I'll check. I don't even remember now.
Okay.
Yeah.
But even... So
just use a synthetic rating.
I'll just use a synthetic one. Okay. Yes.
Sure. Just so I can have a stronger understanding when it comes to inflation and the strength of currency. Because my understanding was that strength of currency is determined in relation to another currency in their rate of inflation.
In the long term. In the short term, it could be driven by all kinds of things, right? The dollar can become stronger or weaker against the currency. So in the long term, purchasing power parity can rise. In the short term, anything can rise.
Okay, so in the short term, it would be like...
Could be central banking.
Central banking would drive that. Mm-hmm. So that's why it wouldn't necessarily be the strengthening of the current, weakness of the currency that would possibly make it easier for the company.
Yeah, you can't make a leap that weak currencies mean higher inflation. That's not necessarily true. It could happen, but it doesn't.
Okay. It's a possible result, but not necessarily the cause.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yes.
Short question about the project.
Yeah.
For my company, I couldn't find the marginal tax rate, but effective tax rate.
Company, the marginal tax rate doesn't come from the company, it comes from the country that the country is in.
Oh, sorry.
Companies.
Should I look use at the effective tax rate?
No, the marginal tax, you have to look at the tax rate for the country. Okay. It's US will be 40%. Okay, come on.